This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen, and this is episode 53 of What's It Like. My guest is Tom Stanglin, woodworker somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ken.
Where exactly are you?
I'm located in Seattle in beautiful Georgetown, right next to a statuary lot and by the Get a Vacuum Cleaner Repair and Get a Free Bible.
Yes.
And the biggest notable landmark is the original very first Costco right up the street.
Good to know. Good to know. So did you always want to be a woodworker?
It's interesting. I don't think that it was so much that I ever wanted to be one, that I just was one. And growing up, I actually got good grades in school and all that. And, you know, kids that got good grades, they didn't take woodshop class where, you know, I went to school. They were trained for college prep.
Yeah.
And, you know, so... I'm 51, and when I was going to high school, I graduated in 78. We did our college applications a little bit differently. You know, I remember being accepted into college by the time, at the beginning of my senior year. So basically, the counselors wanted us to have all of our college prep classes done our junior year. So I'd been accepted into school. My senior year, I'd taken all the advanced classes, so there wasn't a whole lot left for me to take. So I took music classes and I took woodshop my senior year. But in the meantime, I mean, since the age of 10, I'd been building things and making things just because I kind of couldn't help myself.
Where did you grow up?
My parents were corporate nomads, so I grew up where my father's corporate job took him. So I was born in Wisconsin, lived there till the ripe old age of 2, and lived in Maryland, right outside of D.C. And then we moved to New York, Long Island, and then right before high school, I moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. I went to high school there, but at the age of 9 or 10, when I was living in New York, we visited Seattle. I had an older sister that was going to graduate school here, and she lived on a houseboat, and, you know, at the age of 9 or 10.
That's very impressive. Mounds,
yeah, being on a houseboat, it's like, this is for me, this is where I'm going. And we were across the lake from the University of Washington. And
yeah.
I decided as a little boy that I wanted to go to the University of Washington. And then I kind of forgot about that, but I kept visiting Seattle, and then I had to apply to college. And, you know, I knew I wanted to move to Seattle, so I applied to the University of Washington, was accepted, and I have never lived anyplace else.
So do you live on a houseboat?
I did, actually.
Did you?
I had a houseboat for about a dozen years. In fact, my son was born. We had a home birth, and he was born on a houseboat.
Wow.
But I haven't had a houseboat for years.
Just like Sleepless in Seattle.
It was like that. It's definitely a romantic thing, but
yes.
With any romances, they can have their ups and downs. And so I'm done with houseboats.
When you were growing up, who had the largest influence on your life?
Boy, you know, I'm going to take that from a different perspective a little bit, because the first thing that popped into my mind was my woodworking mentor, and I didn't meet him until I was 18 years old. And he was an extremely talented man. Unfortunately, he died at the age of 40, so his fame kind of diminished because he just had such a short time to work. But he was the partner of my brother-in-law when I first moved out here. He and my brother-in-law were buying kind of crummy houses and rehabbing them and turning them and making money. That was how they were making money. And in the time that he wasn't working, this fellow Emmett Day would go off to his basement, make these beautiful pieces of furniture out of really exotic and beautiful woods. And, you know, up until that time, I'd been making things and really loved making things. And, you know, when I met him, I was exposed to these fabulous materials that were trees. You know, you look at rosewood, and how can that possibly come from a tree? And satinwood, something golden color. So, and a lot of the aspects of life, you see, I never considered that woodworking could be a career. You know, woodworking was a hobby. And also, I sort of had this idea that people weren't supposed to like their jobs. I mean, that was sort of throughout all TV culture and all that, people had the jobs they hated and they lived for the weekend and all that. And so I figured I would never have a job as a woodworker because I like it too much, you know. And Emmett was the one that showed me, it's like, no, you can have a job and really like it. And you can figure out a way to make money at this.
How did he become your mentor?
Well, I started working for them, and he was making these beautiful items. So, and this is kind of how I learned many things. On a certain level, I could say that I'm self-taught as far as woodworking goes because I never attended a school, but I think that would do a disservice to my mentor and all the other teachers I've had. So, you know, when I hear the term somebody says they're self-taught, I look at them and wonder, did they grow up in a bubble? Did they never see a magazine? You know, so basically, I saw Emmett working, and what I'd do is I'd sit in my shop. I even worked for him for free, you know, and basically, he couldn't get rid of me. When I found something I wanted to learn, I'd, as politely as I could, insinuate myself into the position to make it just easier for them to teach me because I wasn't going anywhere, you know. So people would teach me, and I'd be grateful, and I'd try to help in kind as I could. But, you know, when you're young and learning and don't have any money and all that, you know, there's not a whole lot to offer but what you can give them with your time.
But you volunteered, essentially.
Yeah. I've done a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. So did you enjoy the process of becoming a woodworker?
Well, you know, during the time I moved out here, and I kind of made a deal with my folks that I would get a college degree. But when I moved out, I, you know, had this opportunity to learn carpentry with my brother-in-law and this cool guy, Emmett. So I took a year off, and I told my parents that, hey, if I move out for a year and establish residency, I'll have in-state tuition. And, of course, that appealed to their, you know, economy, and it got me learning how to make things even on a bigger scale. But then a year went by, and, you know, my parents were leaning on me, and I did make the deal. So I went to school. Then I went to school for 2 years, and then I took a year off in between and traveled, and ended up working for Emmett in his shop again. And then after 1 year off, I went back and finished up my college degree, and I got a degree in history, which isn't terribly practical, but I, you know, had a focus on French art and architecture, and it definitely has informed my furniture making. And, you know, having a general background in education is always a good thing.
Right.
But as soon as I graduated, and since I had such a focus on France, I actually went to France for about a half a year and was actually getting under-the-counter jobs working over there and helping people work on their houses and all that. But it was very difficult to land jobs, and I didn't really have tools over there. So after about a half a year or so, I came back, and I went and knocked on Emmett's door and worked for him free for about a week, and then he hired me because he couldn't get rid of me. And that's sort of how I came into woodworking, because it's what I did. I mean, a lot of people look at college, I think, as a vocational school, and I looked at it purely as an education, and once I was done, then you fall back on what you do. And what did I do? I made things.
Yeah, and that's what college is for, is to give you a broad background.
I agree. It also basically teaches you what you don't know. It doesn't teach you something.
Yes.
It shows you where you're going to have to go and what you're going to have to learn to really excel in a certain field.
And how large the world of knowledge is.
Yes.
So what exactly do you do?
Well, you know, I do many things. In the furniture world, I'm a designer craftsman. I design things. I also have a line of furniture. And how I established that line was, you know, people came to me and they say, we'd like something like this. Could you do something like that? And when I'd make a really nice design, I go, wow. Developing a design is a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of time that you don't necessarily get back the first time you make it. And so when something really appealed to me, you know, I'd file that way and maybe I'd make another one, mm-hmm. you know, at the same time. And I'm part of a cooperative gallery in Seattle called Northwest Fine Woodworking, which is one of the venues that I market my work. And so I'd put it on the floor and see if it flies. And sure enough, if it sold, I would continue to make it. And people would see that and they'd say, oh, can you do this? And, you know, once again, the line kind of built on itself. And so my work is inspired by these architects named Green and Green, whose work was prevalent more than a century ago. It was part of what's known as the arts and crafts movement. Now, before I got my first commission for the arts and crafts, if you would have asked me if I was interested in doing that, I'd have said, no, You know, I like, you know, the arts and crafts movement, this furniture is defined, it's largely mahogany with ebony details. Now, the craftsmanship is exquisite, but the palette is somewhat subdued. Now, I'd mentioned earlier that I'd been exposed to Brazilian rosewood and satin wood, and we do gold and silver inlay and, you know, just mahogany. it's kind of boring and plain by comparison. But what it doesn't let you rely on the wood to be the whole show. You know, all of a sudden when you have mahogany is a very beautiful wood, but it's not the Lindsay Lohan, the really flamboyant kind of beautiful can't misser kind of a thing. It's more the steady pretty girl next door kind of a thing. And with that, style and shape and form really become manifest. If you start to do style and shape of form on a highly figured piece of wood, you got to let the wood dictate. Mm. When you're dealing with something that's more straight grain, then the style and the design begin to dictate and the material molds itself more to it, if that makes sense.
When I think of mahogany, I think of my kitchen table when I was a kid. The dining room table was a mahogany table, but it was stained dark red.
Well, it often becomes very dark red. You know, that's its nature. If you now you're a Seattleite, aren't you, Ken?
I grew up in Seattle, yes.
Okay, so if you think of Lake Union, you know, those classic old Chris Craft mahogany boats, and they're very dark.
Yeah,
and I
true.
Think that that's just the oxidation over time. You know, sometimes it fades, sometimes it gets darker. It can go either way. But yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Without the stain, it actually, as you say, it has grain that you can see, but it's nice and fine grain. It's not like
very fine grain wood.
It's not like a big oak kind of running grain.
Right, with lots of rays and all that. Yeah, yeah.
What's the best thing about your job?
Well, I get to pick the radio station. You know, that's always been very important. I pick my own hours, which means I work all the time. I choose my own projects, which frustrate me no end. Actually, no, that's not true. There are a lot of times, especially when the economy got bad, I didn't have as much work as I used to do. I used to have several employees, and that was very interesting because that changed the job for me. I had to learn to manage people. I had to learn how to do payroll and bookkeeping. And that was very nice because at that point of my life, I had really established that I was a master craftsman, and I needed a somewhat different challenge. And I got that through learning business. And I did that for a while, but then I realized, boy, having all these people is making me a businessman. And it was really nice and interesting to learn, but I really want to be a craftsman. So I knew that ideally, I only have one or two employees. Mm. That way I'm not constantly drumming up work for everybody. Now, of course, now things are a little bit different where, you know, I don't have any employees because people are just worried about spending money. So, but now I think I've lost the thread of the question. What's the best thing about my job? The best thing about my job simply is I get to make things and I get to make the things that I enjoy making. You know, I love the aspect of creation. I love design. And in this craft, it's a constant state of practice. You know, you have to do it all the time. You know, it's not something you can, it may be something that you can pick up and set down, but it always builds upon itself. And the more you do something, the better you become at it. And maybe that's the best thing about my job.
What's the worst thing about your job?
having to work all the time,
mm-hmm.
skipping vacations, not getting paid a lot of money. There was a period of time, once again, when I did have a lot of employees, and I was making money, and I, you know, got down to working, you know, just like, you know, 40 hours a week sometimes. And my older son, you know, he was with me, you know, at the beginning of my career when I, you know, 80 hours a week was pretty normal. You know, I basically came home to make him dinner, and then oftentimes I'd go back to work, and that was just to get the bills paid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be sitting, you know, I'd be at the grocery store, at the coffee shop, taking a break, and I'd hear people talking about how hard they're working and they're finally getting their 2-week vacation. You know, it's like, I never got that. You know, I never had any of that. And I remember feeling resentful of that a little bit, but you know, I made my choices. You
yeah.
know, I wanted to do this. So the hardest part is while you get to do what you want to do, you do pay a price for it in free time, you know, and a lot of people look at it, it's like, oh, you get to do what you love. It's like, oh yeah, you get to do it all the time. and so that can be a little tough, but you know, you have to come to terms yourself with that. You know, I have people come to me wanting a job, and they'd be coming out of, oh, there was one fellow that was working for a university as a researcher or something like that, and he thought it would be nice to be a woodworker. And he told me he needed to make $12 an hour, and of course he'd need benefits, and he'd need some vacation time. And I said, well, that's great, you know, and I'd be paying you more and giving you more time off than I ever get. And I'd be the boss. I was like, nah, it's not going to work. So you got to be willing to do without those perks, and they'll come back to you
mm-hmm.
Certain ways.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Well, the person has to be very disciplined, very self-directed. It's good to not have a lot of self-doubt, because that creeps in all the time. You know, it's unavoidable. You have to have a lot of determination and a lot of resolve. And also to do this, it's not actually a quality I'd necessarily want to brag about. It's not just foreign to me, doesn't just apply to me, but it's something that I've noticed among a lot of my craftsmen peers, for instance. There's a certain part of them that has to be very selfish. You know, to do this, you got to take a lot of time. And in the normal world, that time's going to come from the family and your relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a really supportive family, and I'm very grateful for that. And they do understand that when I have to really work hard, you know, that it's not that I don't want to be around them, but it's that I need to accomplish something.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the salient example that stands out is when I had my very first one-man show. And this was in, I believe it was in 1991 or 1992. I was 31 years old, which would have made my eldest son 11. And I was single parenting at the time, and I was working around the clock to get ready for my show. In fact, my siblings said, is there anything we could do to help you? And I'd say, take Jamie to a movie, do something with him. Well, one Saturday there was nobody to come and play with Jamie. And so Jamie walked down to my shop, which was in our neighborhood. And I was in an old mom and pop grocery store, and there were big plate glass windows in front, and there was a bench in front. And so Jamie came down on a Saturday afternoon, and he came to talk to me, and I said, gee, Jamie, I'm sorry, I just can't play, I don't have time to do anything, I got to get this work done. So we went out in front of the shop and put his head in his hands and sat slumped over on the bench all sad. And after a few minutes, I had to go out there, and I said, Jamie, I'm really sorry I can't play with you, but I'm going to have to ask you to move because it's breaking my heart watching you there, and I can't get any work done. And so that was truly a very selfish moment on my part. But, you know, this was my first chance, and I had to give it all that I had, and I needed him to not do that, because if he kept sitting there, I wasn't going to be able to work because I'd feel too bad. So that's that part of being selfish. Now, I mentioned that I was part of a cooperative gallery. the majority of craftspeople that I know, they don't have children. And I don't know if that's a financial thing or a time thing, but, you know, that much is true. And in a certain way, it's kind of sad, but I kind of understand why that is. Because, you know, having a family takes a lot of time and a lot of money.
When you have a show, is it like an art gallery kind of show?
Yes, this is definitely an art gallery show. In fact, my gallery is at First and Jackson. It's in the gallery district.
Oh.
So there's a First Thursday opening and wine and cheese and all that kind of stuff.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day for you?
Well, I actually do have a pretty good rhythm. I mean, basically every day I wake up and have coffee and read the paper at home, and I dress up in gym clothes, and then my wife and I go down to the gym and we have a little workout that we do together, and then she goes off to her job on the bus and I drive down to my shop, and then I come in and I look at my email and have my breakfast and respond to my emails, and then I go back to the projects I have in front of me, and I will work on those projects, whatever they might be, and, you know, have lunch around 12 or 1 and keep working till 5:30 or 6 on a normal day and go home and make dinner for the family and promptly fall asleep in front of the TV, you know. And that's generally, except for the day that I have to go shopping, I plan out the meals, and oftentimes I'll take part of the day on Saturday or Sunday, and my wife and I all, that turns into date time and we'll go shopping. But generally, you know, that routine goes 6.5 days a week. So I basically work every day. I'm not just a furniture maker. Some crazy thing in me decided that, you know, I took a perfectly good hobby and turned it into a career. And I realized that when times were good and I did actually have a free time, I didn't know what to do with myself because all I ever did was woodworking. So I decided that I was going to have a hobby and I was going to start collecting wine. Now, one of the things I didn't mention, I think I said that one of the things I do is make things. When I was going to college, one of my ways of working through college is I was a dinner chef, because making food and making furniture, to me, are very similar things. Mm. The process is very similar. The primary difference is time and what the ingredients are. You know, but basically, you have to be very skilled, you have to have a really good plan, you have to know what you're doing, and you have to proceed decisively. And so, you know, that was one of the things that actually kept me sane while I was going through college, was working in restaurants and making things. So I always had a food background, but, you know, once again, when I looked at my my food mentors, you know, a lot of them, you know, in those days, the celebrity chef thing didn't really exist. And what I saw were older people that were working. It's the difference between woodworking and food, too, is food is more immediate and it becomes way more stressful, okay? You have ingredients. They can go bad in a day. A piece of wood, it doesn't go bad in a day. It takes a long time. Stress level goes way down. The expectation. Somebody orders a chair from me, they're not expecting to get it within 5 minutes while they're hungry. You know, so so those things change. So you know, my mentor examples in the food business were basically people that had worked very hard, were stressed out, and were largely becoming alcoholics. And so I decided, no, that's not for me. I'm going to stick more toward the furniture aspect of things. But I always included cooking well and food and wine in my life. Now, but I could, you know, as a poor woodworker, I couldn't really afford the kind of wine that, you know, one could aspire to. So once when I stepped that period before our economic crash, I was actually making money. I decided to collect wine as a hobby, but then I needed to learn about it. And I started learning about it, and I'd talk to wine merchants, and well, they're just salesmen. And of course, when you say, well, what wine will age and do well? Well, to their mind, it's going to be the most expensive one. And it's like, okay, I'm feeling hustled here. So I needed to get an education, and I started talking to winemakers. And of course, they started talking about tannin levels, total acidity, the definition of malolactic fermentations, and hybridization of certain vine stocks, root stocks, etc. And boy, I didn't know what they were talking about. So I realized if I want to know more about this, I should do some learning. And I was sitting in bed one Saturday morning, and I read an article about the South Seattle Community College that started an enology program. And they had their winemaking program. So I called them up the next Monday and enrolled a little bit later, thinking that I'd just learn about wine. But, you know, you take a guy that's used to making things and start to teach him how to make something, well, how can he not do it? You're also taking a guy that took one perfectly good hobby and turned it into a career, and, well, now I'm a commercially bonded winery.
Well, of course.
You know, see, there's a legality. If you want to make more than 3 barrels of wine in the United States, you need to be a commercially bonded winery.
Wow.
Because, you know, that's more than personal consumption.
I would think.
And, of course, 3 barrels is way more. 3 barrels is 75 cases. And to give you an idea of what 1 barrel of wine is, if you sat down with your wife or your partner and had 1 bottle of wine with dinner shared 5 times a week, a barrel of wine would last you an entire year. So that's a lot of wine. So 3 barrels, you know, that's way more than you need for personal use. So
it's probably a fair rule then.
So and the other side is there's all these different grapes, all these different varieties. Then there's these different places to get the grapes. So you want to have all these different barrels. You know, the experiments are endless. And so. So
you don't have to grow your own grapes?
No, I don't grow the grapes, but I'll also add that I don't grow trees either. I'm one that likes to get I like to go pick the natural resources, having your preferred vendors is really important. You know, one of the things that people ask me when I teach classes in woodworking, one of the first things on my list is have a really good relationship with your lumber yard. You don't want your tally man upset with you because they're the one that control the stacks of wood, you know, so mm-hmm. You always want to get along well with them.
So, Tom, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
How do I get myself motivated? I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I had to make a decision whether I was going to go on a little trip with my family. And I decided not to because I had all these things hanging over my head, and I had that little churning in my belly. So I decided to come down to the shop. I cleaned up, and I thought I'd take a look at my finances for one. And I did a little balance sheet, and I saw all the things I had to spend money on in the coming time and the amounts of money coming in. And that was very motivating. Okay. but actually, So that was money and or fear as motivation. That kind of works, but really that's not the motivation. Truly, the challenge, the creative challenge, has always been the motivation. You know, I mean, clearly I don't do this for the money, you know, because there's not a lot there. Now that being said, there really aren't a lot of successful woodworkers. Anybody that puts a table saw in their garage immediately becomes my competition, and they start by, oh, Tom sells that chair for $1,500. I'll sell mine for $1,400. Okay, so I lose business for a while until that guy goes out of business. Okay, and then they come back, you know. Or oftentimes people will buy a table and say, oh, the chairs are too expensive, and then they'll go around looking at the other chairs, and they'll find that, well, gee whiz, you know, all the other chairs that might cost less, they look horrible by my table. So many times I've had this and people end up coming back, you know, so, but that's not speaking directly to motivation. Motivation, I think that that's just not such an issue. I think one of the initial keys we started with is that you've got to be disciplined and motivated. So I think that I don't lack motivation most of the time. Although there are days where getting up, as much as I love doing this, sometimes it's work. And I've often described myself as this. You know, sometimes the end just doesn't seem in sight. You know, so I start plotting. And I use this analogy. You know, imagine that you have a wall. It's a long wall. And way at one end, there's a doorway. Now, I imagine myself walking headlong into this wall. And just due to the rotation of the earth and all that, if I keep walking straight at the wall, not really getting anywhere, I tend to slide a little closer to that opening. Okay. And that's what plodding is to me, because eventually, if I keep plodding, I'll slide far enough that I'll get through that doorway. Okay. And then I've gone to the next step. Now, if I just stop, well, I won't get anywhere. So I keep walking into that wall, keep moving, and that's what it feels like sometimes. And sometimes I feel like I'm in a jet stream, like I'm flying. But a lot of the time in woodworking, it's the slower aspect. And I just keep going. I'm determined.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Did I mention I make wine? you know, I mentioned that I do most of the cooking for the family, and no matter what I've got going on, with a few exceptions, okay, if I've got a lot of people here, let's say I'm bottling, and I've got half a dozen volunteers sitting here, and it looks like it's going to go late, okay, I call up the home front, and they take care of dinner. But otherwise, you know, on any normal night, I go home, I make dinner, you know, that's grounding, that's a daily activity. You know, we have wine with dinner, I talk to my wife, I feed the cat, I do all those things. You know, you live normally. Try to, yeah, calming yourself down. And that's just, you know, it's nice not to go, one of the things I learned, and I really did learn this from my mentor, is let's not be a prima donna artist. Let's not be this guy that yells at people. There was this one movie I saw once, The Red Violin, and this master violin maker, this student came and brought his violin to the master violin maker, and the violin maker looked at it, and then he strummed a chord, and then he smashed the thing. It's like, oh my God, you know, what possible good can that be for anybody? And I don't want to be that guy. You know, I want to be the guy that loves his wife and his kids and is approachable and might even be raking his yard and you can go talk to him. You know, that's the guy I'd rather be.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
There have been many. And I'm trying to think. Well, you know, one of the most challenging things has probably been to be, it's not so much in the woodworking or even in the winemaking, but definitely in the being a parent and being a good husband. You know, I think being a good human being is the biggest challenge. You know, being good at your craft, yeah, anybody can accomplish that. I think, give it enough time. But being a really good human being a good parent, you know, that's a whole different set of challenges. And I think, you know, that's referring back to my mentor. That's one of the things I learned from him. You know, these are the things that really matter. You know, you might become a footnote because you made a great chair, but you know, raising your family well—that's going to serve humanity.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through these challenges?
You know, I have a little piece of wood that came from a dairy. It was part of a milk crate, and it was the Golden Rule dairy. And I think that a really good operating maxim is the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
If you're giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Well, definitely follow your passions and be ready for the consequences, you know, to put it in a nutshell. You know, it's, you've only got so much time on this planet, and you want to do what you want to do. There are no excuses. You're the only one that can take responsibility for what happens to you.
We often have events in our lives that shape us and people we've met, places we've been. So think of a defining moment in your life you haven't talked about or something you wanted to say and haven't said yet. What question should I have asked you to get you to tell me that story?
A defining moment, you know, I think back in my life, and there have probably been many, but, you know, off the tip of my tongue, I'm trying to think. Well, you know, actually, I think there is a defining moment, and I kind of touched on this earlier, and it's, on one hand, it's sort of like blowing my own horn, and I really try not to do that. But there was a point more than a decade ago, maybe even longer than that, I was training somebody, and I realized I'd become a master craftsman. At that point, and it was always kind of my goal. It was kind of like a secret, unspoken goal. It wasn't something I talked about. But I wanted to master this, okay? And I wanted to master it because, you know, if I master something, you know, it might spread in a good way, the rest of me. And I remember trying to teach this fella how to do something, and I grabbed a chisel, and it was completely the wrong chisel. You know, I was taking just a flat chisel to make a round shape and all that, but I just took it without thinking. I just moved it in all the right ways. I saw it. I could just see it, and I knew where I had to move that chisel to make this shape immediately. It wasn't planned. It was just spontaneous, and I realized I can see things. I can see, I can visualize things, and I can take a shape, and I can make that a shape. And that is part of the mastery that I always wanted, and that's when I realized, it was a big moment for me, I realized I'd become a master craftsman. And it was one of those personal eureka moments. It's nothing I even mentioned to the helper that I had with me that day. And I think it might be a story I think I've only privately told two or three other times, but that was a significant point, and that's when I knew I didn't have to be so aggressive at the learning, that I could actually let my learning instead be linear. I became more horizontal in my learning, if that makes any sense. It made sense to me, and I can see how that worked. You know, but I just didn't have to. I didn't have to prove anything anymore, I think, was the larger issue.
I want to thank Tom Stanglin for joining me today. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ken.